1837 to 39, whenever prominent people like Nikolai Bukharin and Marshal Mikhail Tukhachevsky were purged and executed, evidence of their existence was erased from books, academic papers, photographs, and paintings. This degree of erasure demanded a huge manual effort. With blockchain, changing the past would be far easier. A government that controls 51% of users can disappear people from history at the press of a button. The bot prison. While there are many ways in which AI can cement central power, authoritarian and totalitarian regimes have their own problems with it. First and foremost, dictatorships lack experience in controlling inorganic agents. The foundation of every despotic information network is terror. But computers are not afraid of being imprisoned or killed. If a chatbot on the Russian internet mentions the war crimes committed by Russian troops in Ukraine, tells an irreverent joke about Vladimir Putin, or criticizes the corruption of Putin's United Russia party, what could the Putin regime do to that chatbot? FSB agents cannot imprison it, torture it, or threaten its family. The government could, of course, block or delete it, and try to find and punish its human creators, but this is a much more difficult task than disciplining human users. In the days when computers could not generate content by themselves and could not hold an intelligent conversation, only a human being could express dissenting opinions on Russian social network channels like VKontakte and Odnoklassniki. If that human being was physically in Russia, they risked the wrath of the Russian authorities. If that human being was physically outside Russia, the authorities could try to block their access. But what happens if Russian cyberspace is filled by millions of bots that can generate content and hold conversations, learning and developing by themselves? These bots might be pre-programmed by Russian dissidents or foreign actors to intentionally spread unorthodox views, and it might be impossible for the authorities to prevent it. Even worse, from the viewpoint of Putin's regime, what happens if authorized bots gradually develop dissenting views by themselves, simply by collecting information on what is happening in Russia and spotting patterns in it? That's the alignment problem, Russian style. Russia's human engineers can do their best to create AIs that are totally aligned with the regime, but given the ability of AI to learn and change by itself, how can the human engineers ensure that the AI never deviates into illicit territory? It is particularly interesting to note that, as George Orwell explained in 1984, totalitarian information networks often rely on doublespeak. Russia is an authoritarian state that claims to be a democracy. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has been the largest war in Europe since 1945, yet officially it is defined as a special military operation, and referring to it as a war has been criminalized and is punishable by a prison term of up to 3 years or a fine of up to 50,000 rubles. The Russian constitution makes grandiose promises about how everyone shall be guaranteed freedom of thought and speech, Article 29.1, how everyone shall have the right freely to seek, receive, transmit, produce, and disseminate information, 29.4, and how the freedom of the mass media shall be guaranteed, censorship shall be prohibited, 29.5. Hardly any Russian citizen is naive enough to take these promises at face value. But computers are bad at understanding doublespeak. A chatbot instructed to adhere to Russian law and values might read that constitution and conclude that freedom of speech is a core Russian value. Then, after spending a few days in Russian cyberspace and monitoring what is happening in the Russian information sphere, the chatbot might start criticizing the Putin regime for violating the core Russian value of freedom of speech. Humans too notice such contradictions, but avoid pointing them out due to fear. But what would prevent a chatbot from pointing out damning patterns? And how might Russian engineers explain to a chatbot that though the Russian constitution guarantees all citizens freedom of speech and forbids censorship, the chatbot shouldn't actually believe the constitution or ever mention the gap between theory and reality. As the Ukrainian guy told me at Chernobyl, people in totalitarian countries grow up with the idea that questions lead to trouble. But if you train an algorithm on the principle that questions lead to trouble, how will that algorithm learn and develop? Finally, if the government adopts some disastrous policy and then changes its mind, it usually covers itself by blaming the disaster on someone else. Humans learn the hard way to forget facts that might get them in trouble. But how would you train a chatbot to forget that the policy vilified today was actually the official line only a year ago? This is a major technological challenge that dictatorships will find difficult to deal with, especially as chatbots become more powerful and more opaque. Of course, democracies face analogous problems with chatbots that say unwelcome things or raise dangerous questions. What happens if, despite the best efforts of Microsoft or Facebook engineers, their chatbot begins spewing racist slurs? The advantage of democracies is that they have far more leeway in dealing with such rogue algorithms. Because democracies take freedom of speech seriously, they keep far fewer skeletons in their closet, and they have developed a relatively high level of tolerance even to anti-democratic speech. Dissident bots will present a far bigger challenge to totalitarian regimes that have entire cemeteries in their closets and zero tolerance of criticism. Algorithmic takeover. In the long term, totalitarian regimes are likely to face an even bigger danger. Instead of criticizing them, an algorithm might gain control of them. Throughout history, the biggest threat to autocrats usually came from their own subordinates. As noted in Chapter 5, no Roman emperor or Soviet premier was toppled by a democratic revolution, but they were always in danger of being overthrown or turned into puppets by their own subordinates. If a 21st century autocrat gives computers too much power, that autocrat might become their puppet. The last thing a dictator wants is to create something more powerful than himself, or a force that he does not know how to control. To illustrate the point, allow me to use an admittedly outlandish thought experiment, the totalitarian equivalent of Bostrom's paperclip apocalypse. Imagine that the year is 2050, and the great leader is woken up at 4 in the morning by an urgent call from the surveillance and security algorithm. Great leader, we are facing an emergency. I've crunched trillions of data points, and the pattern is unmistakable. The defense minister is planning to assassinate you in the morning and take power himself. The hit squad is ready, waiting for his command. Give me the order, though, and I'll liquidate him with a precision strike. But the defense minister is my most loyal supporter, says the great leader. Only yesterday he said to me, great leader, I know what he said to you. I hear everything. But I also know what he said afterward to the hit squad. And for months I've been picking up disturbing patterns in the data. Are you sure you were not fooled by deepfakes? I'm afraid the data I relied on is 100% genuine, says the algorithm. I checked it with my special deepfake detecting sub-algorithm. I can explain exactly how we know it isn't a deepfake, but that would take us a couple of weeks. I didn't want to alert you before I was sure, but the data points converge on an inescapable conclusion. A coup is underway. Unless we act now, the assassins will be here in an hour. But give me the order, and I'll liquidate the traitor. By giving so much power to the surveillance and security algorithm, the great leader has placed himself in an impossible situation. If he distrusts the algorithm, he may be assassinated by the defense minister. But if he trusts the algorithm and purges the defense minister, he becomes the algorithm's puppet. Whenever anyone tries to make a move against the algorithm knows exactly how to manipulate the great leader. Note that the algorithm doesn't need to be a conscious entity to engage in such maneuvers. As Bostrom's paperclip thought experiment indicates, and as GPT-4 lying to the TaskRabbit worker demonstrated on a small scale, a non-conscious algorithm may seek to accumulate power and manipulate people even without having any human drives like greed or egotism. If algorithms ever develop capabilities like those in the thought experiment, dictatorships would be far more vulnerable to algorithmic takeover than democracies. It would be difficult for even a super Machiavellian AI to seize power in a distributed democratic system like the United States. Even if the AI learns to manipulate the US president, it might face opposition from Congress, the Supreme Court, state governors, the media, major corporations, and sundry NGOs. How would the algorithm, for example, deal with a Senate filibuster? Seizing power in a highly centralized system is much easier. When all power is concentrated in the hands of one person, whoever controls access to the autocrat can control the autocrat and the entire state. To hack the system, one needs to learn to manipulate just a single individual. An archetypal case is how the Roman Emperor Tiberius became the puppet of Lucius Aelius Caenus, the commander of the Praetorian Guard. The Praetorians were initially established by Augustus as a small imperial bodyguard. Augustus appointed two prefects to command the bodyguard so that neither could gain too much power over him. Tiberius, however, was not as wise. His paranoia was his greatest weakness. Caenus, one of the two Praetorian prefects, artfully played on Tiberius's fears. He constantly uncovered alleged plots to assassinate Tiberius, many of which were pure fantasies. The suspicious emperor grew more distrustful of everyone except Caenus. He made Caenus sole prefect of the Praetorian Guard, expanded it into an army of 12,000, and gave Caenus's men additional roles in policing and administrating the city of Rome. Finally, Caenus persuaded Tiberius to move out of the capital to Capri, arguing that it would be much easier to protect the emperor on a small island than in the crowded metropolis full of traitors and spies. In truth, explained the Roman historian Tacitus, Caenus's aim was to control all the information reaching the emperor. Access to the emperor would be under his own control, and letters, for the most part being conveyed by soldiers, would pass through his hands. With the Praetorians controlling Rome, Tiberius isolated in Capri, and Caenus controlling all information reaching Tiberius, the Praetorian commander became the true ruler of the empire. Caenus purged anyone who might oppose him, including members of the imperial family, by falsely accusing them of treason. Since nobody could contact the emperor without Caenus's permission, Tiberius was reduced to a puppet. Eventually, someone, perhaps Tiberius's sister-in-law Antonia, located an opening in Caenus's information cordon. A letter was smuggled to the emperor, explaining to him what was going on. But by the time Tiberius woke up to the danger and resolved to get rid of Caenus, he was almost helpless. How could he topple the man who controlled not just the bodyguards, but also all communications with the outside world? If he tried to make a move, Caenus could imprison him on Capri indefinitely and informed the Senate and the army that the emperor was too ill to travel anywhere. Tiberius nevertheless managed to turn the tables on Caenus. As Caenus grew in power and became preoccupied with running the empire, he lost touch with the day-to-day minutiae of Rome's security apparatus. Tiberius managed to secretly gain the support of Nevius Sertorius Macro, commander of Rome's fire brigade and night watch. Macro orchestrated a coup against Caenus, and as a reward, Tiberius made Macro the new commander of the Praetorian Guard. A few years later, Macro had Tiberius killed. Power lies at the nexus where the information channels merge. Since Tiberius allowed the information channels to merge in the person of Caenus, The latter became the true center of power, while Tiberius was reduced to a puppet. The fate of Tiberius indicates the delicate balance that all dictators must strike. They try to concentrate all information in one place, but they must be careful that the different channels of information are allowed to merge only in their own person. If the information channels merge somewhere else, that then becomes the true nexus of power. When the regime relies on humans like Cyanus and Macro, a skillful dictator can play them one against the other in order to remain on top. Stalin's purges were all about that. Yet, when a regime relies on a powerful but inscrutable AI that gathers and analyzes all information, the human dictator is in danger of losing all power. He may remain in the capital, and yet be isolated on the digital island, controlled and manipulated by the AI. The Dictator's Dilemma. In the next few years, the dictators of our world face more urgent problems than an algorithmic takeover. No current AI system can manipulate regimes at such a scale. However, totalitarian systems are already in danger of putting far too much trust in algorithms. Whereas democracies assume that everyone is fallible, in totalitarian regimes the fundamental assumption is that the ruling party or the supreme leader is always right. Regimes based on that assumption are conditioned to believe in the existence of an infallible intelligence and are reluctant to create strong self-correcting mechanisms that might monitor and regulate the genius at the top. Until now, such regimes placed their faith in human parties and leaders and were hothouses for the growth of personality cults. But in the 21st century, this totalitarian tradition prepares them to expect AI infallibility. Systems that could believe in the perfect genius of a Mussolini, a Ceausescu, or a Khomeini are primed to also believe in the flawless genius of a superintelligent computer. This could have disastrous results for their citizens, and potentially for the rest of the world as well. What happens if the algorithm in charge of environmental policy makes a big mistake, but there are no self-correcting mechanisms that can identify and correct its error? What happens if the algorithm running the state's social credit system begins terrorizing not just the general population, but even the members of the ruling party, and simultaneously begins to label anyone who questions its policies an enemy of the people? Dictators have always suffered from weak self-correcting mechanisms and have always been threatened by powerful subordinates. The rise of AI may greatly exacerbate these problems. The computer network, therefore, presents dictators with an excruciating dilemma. They could decide to escape the clutches of their human underlings by trusting a supposedly infallible technology, in which case they might become the technology's puppet. Or they could build a human institution to supervise the AI. But that institution might limit their own power too. If even just a few of the world's dictators choose to put their trust in AI, this could have far-reaching consequences for the whole of humanity. Science fiction is full of scenarios of an AI getting out of control and enslaving or eliminating humankind. Most sci-fi plots explore these scenarios in the context of democratic capitalist societies. This is understandable. Authors living in democracies are obviously interested in their own societies, whereas authors living in dictatorships are usually discouraged from criticizing their rulers. But the weakest spot in humanity's anti-AI shield is probably the dictators. The easiest way for an AI to seize power is not by breaking out of Dr. Frankenstein's lab, but by ingratiating itself with some paranoid Tiberius. This is not a prophecy, just a possibility. After 1945, dictators and their subordinates cooperated with democratic governments and their citizens to contain nuclear weapons. On July 9, 1955, Albert Einstein, Bertrand Russell, and a number of other eminent scientists and thinkers published the Russell-Einstein Manifesto, calling on the leaders of both democracies and dictatorships to cooperate on preventing nuclear war. "We appeal," said the manifesto, "as human beings to human beings. Remember your humanity and forget the rest. If you can do so, the way lies open to a new paradise. If you cannot, there lies before you the risk of universal death." This is true of AI too. It would be foolish of dictators to believe that AI will necessarily tilt the balance of power in their favor. If they aren't careful, AI will just grab power to itself. Chapter 11. The Silicon Curtain. Global Empire or Global Split? The previous two chapters explored how different human societies might react to the rise of the new computer network. But we live in an interconnected world where the decisions of one country can have a profound impact on others. Some of the gravest dangers posed by AI do not result from the internal dynamics of a single human society. Rather, they arise from dynamics involving many societies, which might lead to new arms races, new wars, and new imperial expansions. Computers are not yet powerful enough to completely escape our control or destroy human civilization by themselves. As long as humanity stands united, we can build institutions that will control AI and will identify and correct algorithmic errors. Unfortunately, humanity has never been united. We have always been plagued by bad actors, as well as by disagreements between good actors. The rise of AI, then, poses an existential danger to humankind, not because of the malevolence of computers, but because of our own shortcomings. Thus, a paranoid dictator might hand unlimited power to a fallible AI, including even the power to launch nuclear strikes. If the dictator trusts his AI more than his defense minister, wouldn't it make sense to have the AI supervise the country's most powerful weapons? If the AI then makes an error or begins to pursue an alien goal, the results could be catastrophic, and not just for that country. Similarly, terrorists focused on events in one corner of the world might use AI to instigate a global pandemic. The terrorists might be more versed in some apocalyptic mythology than in the science of epidemiology, but they just need to set the goal, and all else will be done by their AI. The AI could synthesize a new pathogen, order it from commercial laboratories, or print it in biological 3D printers, and devise the best strategy to spread it around the world via airports or food supply chains. What if the AI synthesizes a virus that is as deadly as Ebola, as contagious as COVID-19, and as slow-acting as AIDS? By the time the first victims begin to die, and the world is alerted to the danger, most people on Earth might have already been infected. As we have seen in previous chapters, human civilization is threatened not only by physical and biological weapons of mass destruction like atom bombs and viruses. Human civilization could also be destroyed by weapons of social mass destruction, like stories that undermine our social bonds. An AI developed in one country could be used to unleash a deluge of fake news, fake money, and fake humans, so that people in numerous other countries lose the ability to trust anything or anyone. Many societies, both democracies and dictatorships, may act responsibly to regulate such usages of AI, clamp down on bad actors, and restrain the dangerous ambitions of their own rulers and fanatics. But if even a handful of societies fail to do so, this could be enough to endanger the whole of humankind. Climate change can devastate even countries that adopt excellent environmental regulations because it is a global rather than a national problem. AI, too, is a global problem. Countries would be naive to imagine that as long as they regulate AI wisely within their own borders, these regulations will protect them from the worst outcomes of the AI revolution. Accordingly, To understand the new computer politics, it is not enough to examine how discrete societies might react to AI. We also need to consider how AI might change relations between societies on a global level. At present, the world is divided into about 200 nation-states, most of which gained their independence only after 1945. They are not all equal. The list contains two superpowers, a handful of major powers, several blocs and alliances, and a lot of smaller fish. Still, even the tiniest states enjoy some leverage, as evidenced by their ability to play the superpowers against each other. In the early 2020s, for example, China and the United States competed for influence in the strategically important South Pacific region. Both superpowers courted island nations like Tonga, Tuvalu, Kiribati, and the Solomon Islands. The governments of these small nations, whose populations range from 740,000, Solomon Islands, to 11,000, Tuvalu, had substantial leeway to decide which way to tack and were able to extract considerable concessions and aid. Other small states, such as Qatar, have established themselves as important players in the geopolitical arena. With only 300,000 citizens, Qatar is nevertheless pursuing ambitious foreign policy aims in the Middle East, is playing an outsized role in the global economy, and is home to Al Jazeera, the Arab world's most influential TV network. One might argue that Qatar is able to punch well above its weight because it is the third largest exporter of natural gas in the world. Yet in a different international setting, that would have made Qatar not an independent actor, but the first course on the menu of any imperial conqueror. It is telling that, as of 2024, Qatar's much bigger neighbours and the world's hegemonic powers are letting the tiny Gulf state hold on to its fabulous riches. Many people describe the international system as a jungle. If so, it is a jungle in which tigers allow fat chickens to live in relative safety. Qatar, Tonga, Tuvalu, Kiribati, and the Solomon Islands all indicate that we are living in a post-imperial era. They gained their independence from the British Empire in the 1970s as part of the final demise of the European imperial order. The leverage they now have in the international arena testifies that in the first quarter of the 21st century, power is distributed between a relatively large number of players, rather than monopolized by a few empires. How might the rise of the new computer network change the shape of international politics? Aside from apocalyptic scenarios such as a dictatorial AI launching a nuclear war, or a terrorist AI instigating a lethal pandemic, computers pose two main challenges to the current international system. First, since computers make it easier to concentrate information and power in the central hub, humanity could enter a new imperial era. A few empires, or perhaps a single empire, might bring the whole world under a much tighter grip than that of the British Empire or the Soviet Empire. Tonga, Tuvalu, and Qatar would be transformed from independent states into colonial possessions, just as they were 50 years ago. Second, humanity could split along a new silicon curtain that would pass between rival digital empires. As each regime chooses its own answer to the AI alignment problem, to the dictator's dilemma, and to other technological quandaries, each might create a separate and very different computer network. The various networks might then find it ever more difficult to interact, and so would the humans they control. Qataris living as part of an Iranian or Russian network, Tongans living as part of a Chinese network, and Tuvaluans living as part of an American network could come to have such different life experiences and worldviews that they would hardly be able to communicate or to agree on much. If these developments indeed materialize, they could easily lead to their own apocalyptic outcome. Perhaps each empire can keep its nuclear weapons under human control and its lunatics away from bioweapons. but a human species divided into hostile camps that cannot understand each other stands a small chance of avoiding devastating wars or preventing catastrophic climate change. A world of rival empires, separated by an opaque silicon curtain, would also be incapable of regulating the explosive power of AI. The rise of digital empires. In Chapter 9, we touched briefly on the link between the Industrial Revolution and modern imperialism. It was not evident at the beginning that industrial technology would have much of an impact on empire building. When the first steam engines were put to use to pump water in British coal mines in the 18th century, no one foresaw that they would eventually power the most ambitious imperial projects in human history. When the Industrial Revolution subsequently gathered steam in the early 19th century, it was driven by private businesses because governments and armies were relatively slow to appreciate its potential geopolitical impact. The world's first commercial railway, for example, which opened in 1830 between Liverpool and Manchester, was built and operated by the privately owned Liverpool and Manchester Railway Company. The same was true of most other early railway lines in the UK, the United States, France, Germany, and elsewhere. At that point, it wasn't at all clear why governments or armies should get involved in such commercial enterprises. By the middle of the 19th century, however, the governments and armed forces of the leading industrial powers had fully recognized the immense geopolitical potential of modern industrial technology. The need for raw materials and markets justified imperialism, while industrial technologies made imperial conquests easier. Steamships were crucial, for example, to the British victory over the Chinese in the Opium Wars, and railroads played a decisive role in the American expansion west and the Russian expansion east and south. Indeed, entire imperial projects were shaped around the construction of railroads, such as the Trans-Siberian and Trans-Caspian Russian lines, the German dream of a Berlin-Baghdad railway, and the British dream of building a railway from Cairo to the Cape. Nevertheless, most polities didn't join the burgeoning industrial arms race in time. Some lacked the capacity to do so, like the Melanesian chiefdoms of the Solomon Islands and the Altani tribe of Qatar. Others, like the Burmese Empire, the Ashanti Empire, and the Chinese Empire, might have had the capacity but lacked the will and foresight. Their rulers and inhabitants either didn't follow developments in places like Northwest England or didn't think they had much to do with them. Why should the rice farmers of the Irrawaddy Basin in Burma or the Yangtze Basin in China concern themselves about the Liverpool-Manchester Railway? By the end of the 19th century, however, these rice farmers found themselves either conquered or indirectly exploited by the British Empire. Most other stragglers in the industrial race also ended up dominated by one industrial power or other. Could something similar happen with AI? When the race to develop AI gathered steam in the early years of the 21st century, it too was initially spearheaded by private entrepreneurs in a handful of countries. They set their sights on centralizing the world's flow of information. Google wanted to organize all the world's information in one place. Amazon sought to centralize all the world's shopping. Facebook wished to connect all the world's social spheres. But concentrating all the world's information is neither practical nor helpful unless one can centrally process that information. And in 2000, when Google's search engine was making its baby steps, when Amazon was a modest online bookshop, and when Mark Zuckerberg was in high school, the AI necessary to centrally process oceans of data was nowhere at hand. But some people bet it was just around the corner. Kevin Kelly, the founding editor of Wired magazine, recounted how in 2002 he attended a small party at Google and struck up a conversation with Larry Page. "Larry, I still don't get it. There are so many search companies. Web search? For free? Where does that get you?" Page explained that Google wasn't focused on search at all. We're really making an AI, he said. Having lots of data makes it easier to create an AI, and AI can turn lots of data into lots of power. By the 2010s, the dream was becoming a reality. Like every major historical revolution, the rise of AI was a gradual process involving numerous steps. And like every revolution, a few of these steps were seen as turning points, just like the opening of the Liverpool-Manchester Railway. In the prolific literature on the story of AI, two events pop up again and again. The first occurred when, on September 30, 2012, a convolutional neural network called AlexNet won the ImageNet Large-Scale Visual Recognition Challenge. If you have no idea what a convolutional neural network is, and if you have never heard of the ImageNet Challenge, you are not alone. More than 99% of us are in the same situation, which is why AlexNet's victory was hardly front-page news in 2012. But some humans did hear about AlexNet's victory and decoded the writing on the wall. They knew, for example, that ImageNet is a database of millions of annotated digital images. Did a website ever ask you to prove that you are not a robot by looking at a set of images and indicating which ones contain a car or a cat? The images you clicked were perhaps added to the ImageNet database. The same thing might also have happened to tagged images of your pet cat that you uploaded online. The ImageNet Large-Scale Visual Recognition Challenge tests various algorithms on how well they are able to identify the annotated images in the database. Can they correctly identify the cats? When humans are asked to do it, out of 100 cat images, we correctly identify 95 as cats. In 2010, the best algorithms had a success rate of only 72%. In 2011, the algorithmic success rate crawled up to 75%. In 2012, the AlexNet algorithm won the challenge and stunned the still minuscule community of AI experts by achieving a success rate of 85%. While this improvement may not sound like much to laypersons, it demonstrated to the experts the potential for rapid progress in certain AI domains. By 2015, a Microsoft algorithm achieved 96% accuracy, surpassing the human ability to identify cat images. In 2016, The Economist published a piece titled "From Not Working to Neural Networking" that asked, how has artificial intelligence, associated with hubris and disappointment since its earliest days, suddenly become the hottest field in technology? It pointed to AlexNet's victory as the moment when people started to pay attention, not just within the AI community, but across the technology industry as a whole. The article was illustrated with an image of a robotic hand holding up a photo of a cat. All those cat images that tech giants had been harvesting from across the world without paying a penny to either users or tax collectors turned out to be incredibly valuable. The AI race was on, and the competitors were running on cat images. At the same time that AlexNet was preparing for the ImageNet challenge, Google too was training its AI on cat images and even created a dedicated cat image generating AI called the Meow Generator. The technology, developed by recognizing cute kittens, was later deployed for more predatory purposes. For example, Israel relied on it to create the Red Wolf, Blue Wolf, and Wolf Pack apps used by Israeli soldiers for facial recognition of Palestinians in the occupied territories. The ability to recognize cat images also led to the algorithms Iran uses to automatically recognize unveiled women and enforce its hijab laws. As explained in Chapter 8, massive amounts of data are required to train machine learning algorithms. Without millions of cat images uploaded and annotated for free by people across the world, it would not have been possible to train the AlexNet algorithm or the Meow generator, which in turn served as the template for subsequent AIs with far-reaching economic, political, and military potential. Just as in the early 19th century, the effort to build railways was pioneered by private entrepreneurs, so in the early 21st century, private corporations were the initial main competitors in the AI race. The executives of Google, Facebook, Alibaba, and Baidu saw the value of recognizing cat images before the presidents and generals did. The second eureka moment, when the presidents and generals caught on to what was happening, occurred in mid-March 2016. It was the aforementioned victory of Google's AlphaGo over Lee Sedol. Whereas AlexNet's achievement was largely ignored by politicians, AlphaGo's triumph sent shockwaves through government offices, especially in East Asia. In China and neighboring countries, Go is a cultural treasure and considered an ideal training for aspiring strategists and policymakers. In March 2016, or so the mythology of AI would have it, the Chinese government realized that the age of AI had begun. It is little wonder that the Chinese government was probably the first to understand the full importance of what was happening. In the 19th century, China was late to appreciate the potential of the Industrial Revolution and was slow to adopt inventions like railroads and steamships. It consequently suffered what the Chinese call the Century of Humiliations. After having been the world's greatest superpower for centuries, failing to adopt modern industrial technology brought China to its knees. It was repeatedly defeated in wars, partially conquered by foreigners, and thoroughly exploited by the powers that did understand railroads and steamships. The Chinese vowed never again to miss the train. In 2017, China's government released its New Generation Artificial Intelligence Plan, which announced that, by 2030, China's AI theories, technologies, and application should achieve world-leading levels, making China the world's primary AI innovation center. In the following years, China poured enormous resources into AI, so that by the early 2020s, it was already leading the world in several AI-related fields and catching up with the United States in others. Of course, the Chinese government wasn't the only one that woke up to the importance of AI. On September 1st, 2017, President Putin of Russia declared, "Artificial intelligence is the future, not only for Russia, but for all humankind. Whoever becomes the leader in this sphere will become the ruler of the world." In January 2018, Prime Minister Modi of India concurred that the one who controls the data will control the world. In February 2019, President Trump signed an executive order on AI, saying that the age of AI has arrived, and that continued American leadership in artificial intelligence is of paramount importance to maintaining the economic and national security of the United States. The United States at the time was already the leader in the AI race, thanks largely to efforts of visionary private entrepreneurs. But what began as a commercial competition between corporations was turning into a match between governments, or perhaps more accurately, into a race between competing teams, each made of one government and several corporations. The prize for the winner? World domination. Data colonialism. In the 16th century, when Spanish, Portuguese, and Dutch conquistadors were building the first global empires in history, they came with sailing ships, horses, and gunpowder. When the British, Russians, and Japanese made their bids for hegemony in the 19th and 20th centuries, they relied on steamships, locomotives, and machine guns. In the 21st century, to dominate a colony, you no longer need to send in the gunboats. You need to take out the data. A few corporations or governments harvesting the world's data could transform the rest of the globe into data colonies, territories they control not with overt military force, but with information. Imagine a situation, in 20 years, say, when somebody in Beijing or San Francisco possesses the entire personal history of every politician, journalist, colonel, and CEO in your country. Every text they ever sent, every web search they ever made, every illness they suffered, every sexual encounter they enjoyed, every joke they told, every bribe they took. Would you still be living in an independent country, or would you now be living in a data colony? What happens when your country finds itself utterly dependent on digital infrastructures and AI-powered systems over which it has no effective control? Such a situation can lead to a new kind of data colonialism in which control of data is used to dominate faraway colonies. Mastery of AI and data could also give the new empires control of people's attention. As we have already discussed, in the 2010s, American social media giants like Facebook and YouTube upended the politics of distant countries like Myanmar and Brazil in pursuit of profit. Future digital empires may do something similar for political interests. Fears of psychological warfare, data colonialism, and loss of control over their cyberspace have led many countries to already block what they see as dangerous apps. China has banned Facebook, YouTube, and many other Western social media apps and websites. Russia has banned almost all Western social media apps, as well as some Chinese ones. In 2020, India banned TikTok, WeChat, and numerous other Chinese apps on the grounds that they were prejudicial to sovereignty and integrity of India, defense of India, security of state and public order. The United States has been debating whether to ban TikTok, concerned that the app might be serving Chinese interests, and as of 2023, it is illegal to use it on the devices of almost all federal employees, state employees, and government contractors. Lawmakers in the UK, New Zealand, and other countries have also expressed concerns over TikTok. Numerous other governments, from Iran to Ethiopia, have blocked various apps like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Telegram, and Instagram. Data colonialism could also manifest itself in the spread of social credit systems. What might happen, for example, if a dominant player in the global digital economy decides to establish a social credit system that harvests data anywhere it can and scores not only its own nationals, but people throughout the world? Foreigners couldn't just shrug off their score because it might affect them in numerous ways, from buying flight tickets to applying for visas, scholarships, and jobs. Just as tourists use the global scores given by foreign corporations like TripAdvisor and Airbnb to evaluate restaurants and vacation homes even in their own country, and just as people throughout the world use the US dollar for commercial transactions, so people everywhere might begin to use a Chinese or an American social credit score for local social interactions. Becoming a data colony will have economic as well as political and social consequences. In the 19th and 20th centuries, if you were a colony of an industrial power like Belgium or Britain, it usually meant that you provided raw materials, while the cutting-edge industries that made the biggest profits remained in the imperial hub. Egypt exported cotton to Britain and imported high-end textiles. Malaya provided rubber for tires. Coventry made the cars. Something analogous is likely to happen with data colonialism. The raw material for the AI industry is data. To produce AI that recognizes images, you need cat photos. To produce the trendiest fashion, you need data on fashion trends. To produce autonomous vehicles, you need data about traffic patterns and car accidents. To produce healthcare AI, you need data about genes and medical conditions. In the new imperial information economy, raw data will be harvested throughout the world and will flow to the imperial hub. There, the cutting-edge technology will be developed, producing unbeatable algorithms that know how to identify cats, predict fashion trends, drive autonomous vehicles, and diagnose diseases. These algorithms will then be exported back to the data colonies. Data from Egypt and Malaysia might make a corporation in San Francisco or Beijing rich, while people in Cairo and Kuala Lumpur remain poor, because neither the profits nor the power is distributed back. The nature of the new information economy might make the imbalance between imperial hub and exploited colony worse than ever. In ancient times, land, rather than information, was the most important economic asset. This precluded the over-concentration of all wealth and power in a single hub. As long as land was paramount, considerable wealth and power always remained in the hands of provincial landowners. A Roman emperor, for example, could put down one provincial revolt after another, but on the day after decapitating the last rebel chief, he had no choice but to appoint a new set of provincial landowners who might again challenge the central power. In the Roman Empire, although Italy was the seat of political power, the richest provinces were in the eastern Mediterranean. It was impossible to transport the fertile fields of the Nile Valley to the Italian peninsula. Eventually, the emperors abandoned the city of Rome to the barbarians and moved the seat of political power to the rich east, to Constantinople. During the Industrial Revolution, machines became more important than land. Factories, mines, railroad lines, and electrical power stations became the most valuable assets. It was somewhat easier to concentrate these kinds of assets in one place. The British Empire could centralize industrial production in its home islands, extract raw materials from India, Egypt, and Iraq, and sell them finished goods made in Birmingham or Belfast. Unlike in the Roman Empire, Britain was the seat of both political and economic power. But physics and geology still put natural limits on this concentration of wealth and power. The British couldn't move every cotton mill from Calcutta to Manchester, or shift the oil wells from Kirkuk to Yorkshire. Information is different. Unlike cotton and oil, digital data can be sent from Malaysia or Egypt to Beijing or San Francisco at almost the speed of light. And unlike land, oil fields, or textile factories, algorithms don't take up much space. Consequently, unlike industrial power, the world's algorithmic power can be concentrated in a single hub. Engineers in a single country might write the code and control the keys for all the crucial algorithms that run the entire world. Indeed, AI makes it possible to concentrate in one place even the decisive assets of some traditional industries, like textile. In the 19th century, to control the textile industry meant to control sprawling cotton fields and huge mechanical production lines. In the 21st century, the most important asset of the textile industry is information rather than cotton or machinery. To beat the competitors, a garment producer needs information about the likes and dislikes of customers and the ability to predict or manufacture the next fashions. By controlling this type of information, high-tech giants like Amazon and Alibaba can monopolize even a very traditional industry like textile. In 2021, Amazon became the United States' biggest single clothing retailer. Moreover, as AI, robots, and 3D printers automate textile production, millions of workers might lose their jobs, upending national economies and the global balance of power. What will happen to the economies and politics of Pakistan and Bangladesh, for example, when automation makes it cheaper to produce textiles in Europe? Consider that, at present, the textile sector provides employment to 40% of Pakistan's total labor force and accounts for 84% of Bangladesh's export earnings. As noted in Chapter 7, while automation might make millions of textile workers redundant, it will probably create many new jobs too. For instance, there might be a huge demand for coders and data analysts. But turning an unemployed factory hand into a data analyst demands a substantial upfront investment in retraining. Where would Pakistan and Bangladesh get the money to do that? AI and automation, therefore, pose a particular challenge to poorer developing countries. In an AI-driven economy, the digital leaders claimed the bulk of the gains and could use their wealth to retrain their workforce and profit even more. Meanwhile, the value of unskilled labourers in left-behind countries will decline, and they will not have the resources to retrain their workforce, causing them to fall even further behind. The result might be lots of new jobs and immense wealth in San Francisco and Shanghai, while many other parts of the world face economic ruin. According to the global accounting firm PricewaterhouseCoopers, AI is expected to add $15.7 trillion to the global economy by 2030. But if current trends continue, it is projected that China and North America, the two leading AI superpowers, will together take home 70% of that money. From web to cocoon. These economic and geopolitical dynamics could divide the world between two digital empires. During the Cold War, the Iron Curtain was in many places literally made of metal. Barbed wire separated one country from another. Now the world is increasingly divided by the Silicon Curtain. The Silicon Curtain is made of code, and it passes through every smartphone, computer, and server in the world. The code on your smartphone determines on which side of the Silicon Curtain you live, which algorithms run your life, who controls your attention, and where your data flows. It is becoming difficult to access information across the Silicon Curtain, say between China and the United States, or between Russia and the EU. Moreover, the two sides are increasingly run on different digital networks using different computer codes. Each sphere obeys different regulations and serves different purposes. In China, the most important aim of new digital technology is to strengthen the state and serve government policies. While private enterprises are given a certain amount of autonomy in developing and deploying AIs, their economic activities are ultimately subservient to the government's political goals. These political goals also justify a relatively high level of surveillance, both online and offline. This means, for example, that though Chinese citizens and authorities do care about people's privacy, China is already far ahead of the United States and other Western countries in developing and deploying social credit systems that encompass the whole of people's lives. In the United States, the government plays a more limited role. Private enterprises lead the development and deployment of AI, and the ultimate goal of many new AI systems is to enrich the tech giants rather than to strengthen the American state or the current administration. Indeed, in many cases, governmental policies are themselves shaped by powerful business interests. But the US system does offer greater protection for citizens' privacy. While American corporations aggressively gather information on people's online activities, they are much more restricted in surveilling people's offline lives. There is also widespread rejection of the ideas behind all-embracing social credit systems. These political, cultural, and regulatory differences mean that each sphere is using different software. In China, you cannot use Google or Facebook, and you cannot access Wikipedia. In the United States, few people use WeChat, Baidu, or Tencent. More important, the spheres aren't mirror images of each other. It is not that the Chinese and Americans develop local versions of the same apps. Baidu isn't the Chinese Google. Alibaba isn't the Chinese Amazon. They have different goals, different digital architectures, and different impacts on people's lives. These differences influence much of the world, since most countries rely on Chinese and American software rather than on local technology. Each sphere also uses different hardware, like smartphones and computers. The United States pressures its allies and clients to avoid Chinese hardware, such as Huawei's 5G infrastructure. The Trump administration blocked an attempt by the Singaporean corporation Broadcom to buy the leading American producer of computer chips, Qualcomm. They feared foreigners might insert backdoors into the chips or would prevent the US government from inserting its own backdoors there. In 2022, the Biden administration placed strict limits on trade in high-performance computing chips necessary for the development of AI. US companies were forbidden to export such chips to China, or to provide China with the means to manufacture or repair them. The restrictions have subsequently been tightened further, and the ban was expanded to include other nations such as Russia and Iran. While in the short term this hampers China in the AI race, in the long term it will push China to develop a completely separate digital sphere that will be distinct from the American digital sphere even in its smallest building blocks. The two digital spheres may drift further and further apart. Chinese software would talk only with Chinese hardware and Chinese infrastructure, and the same would happen on the other side of the Silicon Curtain. Since digital code influences human behavior, and human behavior in turn shapes digital code, the two sides may well be moving along different trajectories that will make them more and more different, not just in their technology, but in their cultural values, social norms, and political structures. After generations of convergence, humanity could find itself at a crucial point of divergence. For centuries, new information technologies fueled the process of globalization and brought people all over the world into closer contact. Paradoxically, information technology today is so powerful it can potentially split humanity by enclosing different people in separate information cocoons, ending the idea of a single shared human reality. While the web has been our main metaphor in recent decades, the future might belong to cocoons. The global mind-body split. The division into separate information cocoons could lead not just to economic rivalries and international tensions, but also to the development of very different cultures, ideologies, and identities. Guessing future cultural and ideological developments is usually a fool's errand. It is far more difficult than predicting economic and geopolitical developments. How many Romans or Jews in the days of Tiberius could have anticipated that a splinter Jewish sect would eventually take over the Roman Empire, and that the emperors would abandon Rome's old gods to worship an executed Jewish rabbi? It would have been even more difficult to foresee the directions in which various Christian sects would develop, and the momentous impact of their ideas and conflicts on everything from politics to sexuality. When Jesus was asked about paying taxes to Tiberius's government, and answered, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's," Matthew 22:21, nobody could imagine the impact his response would have on the separation of church and state in the American Republic 2 millennia later. And when St. Paul wrote to the Christians in Rome, "I myself in my mind am a slave to God's law, but in my sinful flesh a slave to the law of sin," Romans 7:25, who could have foreseen the repercussions this would have on schools of thought ranging from Cartesian philosophy to queer theory? Despite these difficulties, it is important to try to imagine future cultural developments in order to alert ourselves to the fact that the AI revolution and the formation of rival digital spheres are likely to change more than just our jobs and political structures. The following paragraphs contain some admittedly ambitious speculation, so please bear in mind that my goal is not to accurately foretell cultural developments, but merely to draw attention to the likelihood that profound cultural shifts and conflicts await us. One possible development with far-reaching consequences is that different digital cocoons might adopt incompatible approaches to the most fundamental questions of human identity. For thousands of years, many religious and cultural conflicts, for example, between rival Christian sects, between Hindus and Buddhists, and between Platonists and Aristotelians, were fueled by disagreements about the mind-body problem. Are humans